patients. We had a slight panel change. And we will go forward with our second case this morning, which is Gonzalez versus State. And we'll ask the clerk to call the case and announce the lawyers, please, if the lawyers are ready to proceed.
The court will now call Christopher Gonzalez versus the State of Texas. You may please support Mr. Danny Berman to argue for the appellant and Mr. David Carroll to argue for the state.
Very good. Mr. Burns, are you ready? Please proceed.
Your Honor, this is a case where a gentleman has been accused of continuous sexual abuse of a child, two different children, and received a rather substantial sentence. The issues, we've raised six issues in this case. All of them are constitutionally based, and they're, I submit to the court that with one exception, which is number six, on the unanimity part, has not been directly addressed by the Supreme Court of the United States yet, but it is still has a federal question as well.
What do you say to the state's position that the constitutional issues were waived because they weren't raised at the trial court level?
I don't believe that the objections and parts were of the Constitution were in effect and were made, as we pointed out. The objections by the defense were sufficient to bring forward, I think, the Constitution. And the state's argument that the confrontation objections or issues were waived is rather a backward attack. This was not the defense's actions. This was the state's action. They made an improper objection, an objection that was frankly frivolous, which cut the defense off from being able to an effective cross-examination of the key witness in this case. And as the court has...
So they made a hearsay objection, which may have not have been a valid objection.
Yes.
But at that point, was the constitutional impact of that ruling brought to the trial court's attention? Was there an objection? How was that developed so that it's preserved for appeal?
I submit to the court that by the fact that they were asking these questions, they were showing that they were trying to simply, and I believe there was a response by the defense, that they were simply trying to show the child doesn't remember. And also the action of they objected to hearsay as well when the state, the defense asked, what did the child look like and what was her reaction while she was being questioned in front of the other child? And again, this was clear, relevant cross-examination issues that should have been allowed. And the fact that the state, again, cut them off with an improper objection, one that doesn't fit, that clearly raises the constitutional issues of your right of cross-examination, and cross-examination is the bedrock of confrontation. Under Davis v. Alaska,
But how do we parlay just a mere, and I don't mean this negatively, but just an evidentiary ruling that's wrong to a constitutional issue if you don't bring that to the trial court's attention? Why should the appellate court be looking at that first? Shouldn't you have brought that to the trial court's attention?
Because the trial court, in sustaining a clearly proper cross-examination question, brings into the case the right of confrontation and the right of cross-examination. It is as...
And so there's no need to preserve that issue, is what you're
saying? I don't think you have to go farther to preserve it than just the fact that you have presented it. It has been cut off by the state's actions, and it's not a proper objection that they made, and they're now being prevented from showing the right, the fact that this child can't remember what's going on, doesn't have a memory of what happened, isn't really a competent child to be testifying in this case. And for that reason, I believe that clearly the constitutional issue of confrontation is brought before the court not by the action of the defense, but by the improper action of the state in cutting off proper cross-examination.
The state didn't really cut off the cross-examination. It was the ruling by the trial court that cut that off.
But
right?
If the state hadn't made that objection, there wouldn't have been a ruling by the trial court.
I understand
and
that.
The court was but incorrect.
But it's the trial court that stands between the two sides and makes sure that there's a level playing field. So it wasn't just the state's action. It was the trial court's ruling as well that you contend was erroneous.
Yes.
And but you didn't or the it, at the trial court level, it wasn't brought to the trial court's attention that these rulings were impairing your ability to cross-examine the witness at a constitutional level. That argument was not made.
Right.
Okay.
I'll concede that argument was not fully made.
And your position is it doesn't have to be made.
Correct.
Okay.
Because
no objection to the objection.
No. Yeah. In effect, Your Honor.
Right.
And I've never seen a case where a person has to make an objection to a improper objection in order to preserve error when that objection is sustained and cut you off from your cross-examination.
What about making an offer of proof to preserve what would have been shown had you properly, or the defense counsel at trial been properly allowed to proceed?
Had, an offer of proof is necessary if it is not obvious from the record itself as to what the defense is trying to do.
Right.
It's quite obvious in this case that the defense was asking about the loss of memory of this child. And I submit to the court, you don't have to make an offer of proof if the record itself shows what you were trying to do and where you were going with this. Okay. If, for example, you were trying to get specific statements from a witness that were necessary to your case, I believe that you would have to make an offer of proof. We expected the witness to say this, this, and this. But when, as here, you're showing that this child, you're just testing, and it's obvious you're testing that this child doesn't remember. This child has no memory. This child has no true recollection of what was going on and happening at the time of this, of her questioning by police officers and the family members and all the others. I believe that based upon that, there is, in fact, a sufficient showing of what they were trying to get to.
Thank you.
And
Mr. Burns,
yes,
you're saying that the trial court abused its discretion because the child was not competent.
Well, that was my first argument, Your Honor, and that was where I was going now. In this case, Your Honor, if you look at the...
But I'm just wondering if you... did you prove up that the child was not competent, or is that just
yes.
because the... objections were sustained?
No, Your Honor. That's a different issue. And on the competency of the child, Your Honor, the very state's very witness that interviewed this child said this child isn't competent. She doesn't know right from wrong. She can't tell truth from fact. This child has no ability to present her testimony before the court. That's my first point of error. And I believe
You think the trial court's bound by a legal determination made by an expert?
Because no, Your Honor, but when you look at the facts and the trial court themselves sees the child being questioned, sees the child making statements both ways, and admits that she can't tell on the tape a truth from a lie, and I was, quite frankly... very shocked in this case that the defense, of all people, admitted the ex parte questioning of this child into evidence. But when you look at the actual tape, you understand why. It shows both from the witness herself and the answer she made during that interview. It's clear she doesn't know truth from a lie. That she's, changing her story as she's going along, that it happened in the kitchen, and then it happened in the bathroom and the bedroom and all the other stuff. She doesn't know the difference between what actually happened and what she is just recalling because somebody's either put it in her mind or she just is making it up. And that's the real issue here. And the question becomes, would any court in the world be able to say that this child, based upon her testimony, her ability to tell her story, should be sent to the penitentiary? Not juvenile court. We're talking about the penitentiary. And because juveniles are subject to going to the penitentiary for perjury. They have to be under the Texas Constitution, or they're not a witness. They can't be a witness. If a witness is not subject to the laws of perjury, Article 1 of the Texas Constitution, Section 5, they are not competent witnesses. Doesn't matter about their religious beliefs or their binding oath, whatever their binding oath, but if they're not subject to the laws of perjury, they are not competent to testify. And you can't say, when you've got the state's own expert telling you that this child doesn't know right from wrong, can't tell truth from falsehood, that this child is in any way competent. The other part is that during the child's testimony before the jury, the state, had kept asking her questions, and she kept going back and forth. And we pointed those points out in our brief where, she was flip-flopping. And the issue is, the state didn't trust this child's testimony either. I mean,
didn't trust it
because they didn't have the courage to ask this child, was this the person who abused you in this courtroom? They wouldn't ask that of her. They were afraid to, I submit. Even after the defense pointed it out to them in their motion for summary judgment, they still wouldn't call the child and say, hey, do you see who did it here?
Was that your first question on cross-examination?
It wasn't the first question, but it was three or four questions in.
Right to it.
Yes. It was right at first. And for that reason, Your Honor, I submit to the court that this child was never shown to be competent. Now, we're going to get some guidance on what should be done in that, I suspect, in the next two or three weeks. There was quite similar case argued before the Supreme Court back in October of last year, I believe it was, and Wood v. Ohio. And we expect the Supreme Court to tell us what happens when a child is incompetent. Can even a third party testify for the child when the child didn't know what was right or wrong? We've shown that this child didn't have that. And this game that we play, if I said that this is red and it's not red, that doesn't test a child's competency. You have to ask true questions, just like Joy Hallam did in her interview, which is a part of this record, and the court can actually look at that full record and see that that child doesn't know what she's talking about. And for that reason, it is a denial of due process. And it is the accused, Mr. Christopher Gonzalez, that this child, the younger child, was allowed to testify in that that manner. The only other issue I'd like to just briefly touch on is the unanimity charge. We have a requirement, both state and federal, that a criminal conviction must be unanimous, and we don't have that in this case. This is not manner and means that we're talking about. We're talking about criminal offenses that have to be committed, and they don't have to agree which criminal offenses were committed. That's not the law. And it can't, they say it's the law, but that can't be the law. can't be constitutionally convicting a person when there's not a unanimous agreement as to what crime he committed. And other than that, unless the court has further questions, that's all I have.
It isn't the crime sexual abuse.
Yes, Your Honor, but it has to be on more than one occasion.
But does it have to be touching or other acts? Does it Do you have to have a jury finding on what were the acts of sexual abuse?
That's what you're saying. I'm contending, because this is not, you know, you can commit it by touching, you can commit it by sexual intercourse, you can commit it by having the child touch you, but rather this is, you have to have separate criminal acts done to the child for it to be a continuing activity. And if you got to have separate criminal acts, you have to have a separate criminal finding by the jury.
And if you do that, don't you have to take care of that in the charge itself? And at the time of trial, did the defense bring an objection to the charge that it?
The defense did not bring an objection to the charge, but I submit to the court.
Isn't that the way to accomplish that? Is
that
through the charge?
Yes, sir.
It would be really the only way, because that's how the jury speaks, is through the charge.
That's true, but the statute, unfortunately, says you can't give that kind of a charge. So it's precluded by statute.
So you're saying the statute is unconstitutional?
Yes.
Because
it doesn't
allow you to granulate out your charge into separate offenses.
Right. Yes, sir.
Let me just ask, if there were six different acts of sexual abuse that occurred in different months, is it your contention that the jury has to agree on the acts that were committed before they can convict?
Yes.
So it's not possible that four jurors could agree that it was Act A, four Act B, and four Act D. They couldn't do that.
Correct, Your Honor. That would be convicting him on basically a four-man jury of each of the three counts.
Well, in a lot of sexual abuse cases, aren't there many acts of sexual abuse?
Yes, Your Honor. And in the regular sexual abuse case, there's two things the defense can do. One, the defense can agree that, you know, they can just wide pan, you got to find one of these is true. And then if you get an acquittal, you're free of everything. They can't come back and prosecute you for any of those other ones. Or you can ask for a specific finding on a specific act. And in that case, you're bound by whatever the jury finds on that. And then if they can try you for the other offenses, because they were extraneous offenses, not the act for which you were being tried.
Do you have a case on that?
Yes, sir. I don't have it here. I didn't sign it, but I will get that case.
I would like to see it.
If I could have a couple of days, Your Honor.
Absolutely.
And I'll get that to you. Unless there are further questions, I'm out of time.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is David Curl. I'm here representing the state. I intend to primarily rely upon our brief. I just had three points that I wanted to make. First, with regard to the Confrontation Clause issue, we cited in our brief five different cases that stand for the proposition that when the judge disallows a question to preserve a Confrontation Clause complaint, you have to object on Confrontation Clause grounds. I've did a little more research, and I found nine more cases that say that, and I'd be happy to submit a letter with those cases if you are interested in it. I don't think it's a controversial point. The second issue is, counsel mentioned that he did object, or you made some comment. The record shows that he made no response to the state's or the trial court sustaining the objection. So that Confrontation Clause issue was certainly not preserved. With regard to the...
excuse me, Mr. Curl, you said you found nine cases. Are they not cited in your brief?
Right, they're not cited in my brief. I have a letter if the court's interested in it. I'd be happy to tender it. I'll give it to the clerk, or is that...
Okay.
The final comment I wanted to make was about the competency of the child. Appellant relies upon Ms. Hollum's interview with the child, but her interview took place about 16 months before trial, and it's really... it's virtually irrelevant. It certainly doesn't control the trial court. And with that, unless there are any questions, I'm going to...
I would like you to speak on the issue about potential lack of unanimity in the jury verdict?
Okay, well, that's been addressed by most of these Texas appellate courts, and they have held that sexual abuse, which is the element, and the ways you prove sexual abuse are manners and means. And this court has addressed that, too. I believe it would take an en banc panel to overrule this court's decision on that regard. And in addition to that, even if there was any merit to appellant's complaint, he needed to preserve that complaint in the trial court, and he didn't do that. So,
how would he preserve that?
He would file a motion to quash, or he would object to the jury charge, or he would just make a constitutional unanimity complaint.
What about just egregious harm, since it's charges a complaint of charge error?
Well, he hasn't made an argument that there's egregious harm, and I don't. I guess I haven't addressed that because I believe his constitutional complaint is unpreserved and without merit. So, I'm not sure how you would actually do an egregious harm standard. I don't know. You have to have two. There, as I recall, there really were three episodes of sexual abuse, and I don't guess how you'd pick which two they would have to rely upon. But I don't believe that. I guess I don't know how you would do an egregious harm test. But since it's been addressed and held not to be error, I guess I'd have to think about that issue.
Okay.
Thanks, sir.
Rebuttal? Mr. Burns?
If the board has further questions, I believe we've covered it, and I will get that case for the court in the next couple of days.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for your arguments and your briefing, and I will say your case is submitted, and you are excused. Thank you very much. And we have another panel change. So we will recess for how long? 10 minutes? 10 minutes? Okay. We'll recess for 10 minutes.